This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, run the latest software update on language, and it doesn't work now. This episode is another installment in the Telling Other Stories series about renaming, and in response to the last episode, The Box, about Erwin Schrödinger of The Eponymous Cat and Equation, Emerson got in touch to offer the following idea. You could call Schrödinger's cat theory simply the Milton theory. This is because I just searched if Schrödinger ever had a cat, and indeed he had one named Milton. Certainly a feasible interpretation. James also asks, if we're not referring to the quantum cat by the name of a paedophile, how should we refer to platonic ideals, solids or loves? I'm taking suggestions. Theallusionist.org/contact. You can also tell me about any renamings you've been involved with. Such things as mountains, products, foods, streets, all sorts of things. This episode contains discussions of anti-black racism, violence and sexual violence. On with the show. Recently, I had a conversation with my parents-in-law about a foodstuff local to them. It's a meatball made of bits of pig offal and meat scraps. And where my in-laws live in the West Midlands, the name of it is the same word as the F-slur used against gay men. We discussed possible replacements for the name. Organ balls. Offal bundles, referring to the etymology of the food's original F-name from a bundle of sticks. They're called ducks in some other areas of England, which is confusing because they're not made of duck and they don't look like a duck or quack like a duck. But that's a lesser problem than sharing a name with a slur. The foodstuff is not connected to the slur in meaning, but some words have been so wrecked by one particular use. Even unrelated uses are infected. Another such word is plantation. For many years, people have been encouraging its removal from the names of products and places, with some results. In 2019, the town of Siena Plantation in Texas became just Siena. That same year, Bigelow Tea began the process of renaming its Plantation Mint Tea to Perfectly Mint, and Bigelow's Charleston Tea Plantation to Charleston Tea Garden. In 2016, Cornell University had agreed that its Cornell Plantations would henceforth be called Cornell Botanic Gardens. The gardens had been named plantations in 1944, not because they had been the kind of plantation tended to by enslaved Africans, but because one of the founders of the gardens wanted to reclaim the sense of the word that meant the acts of plants being planted, or an area that was being cultivated. But in 2016, Cornell conceded that that reclamation was not possible. In 2020, many organisations suddenly realised anti-black racism exists and got busy renaming. The state of Rhode Island voted just to be called that and no longer the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. And in neighbouring Massachusetts, the Living Museum formerly known as Plymouth Plantation became Plymouth Patuxet. Some of the proposed plantation renamings are still in progress. The French drinks company Maison Ferrand announced in 2020 that they would rename their Plantation Rum. At time of recording, the product is still called Plantation Rum. But I wrote to the company asking if they would speak to me about this, and they replied a couple of days ago saying Plantation Rum is very much in the process of rebranding. And they mentioned that the new name will hopefully be announced soon. Nearly 13,000 people signed a petition to rename the town of Plantation, Florida. It's still called Plantation. I don't know where they're at with the process. I can guess. In London, Ontario, in 2019, Lila Wheeler, then aged 9, made a petition saying, "I've been trying to have the name of my street, Plantation Road, changed for the last year. The name of my street means a place where black slaves were forced to work, in horrible conditions, and were often whipped and punished, and sometimes killed. With everything happening in our world right now, slave language needs to be abolished. Please sign the petition and help end racist language." 4,313 people did sign the petition. So far, the street is still called Plantation Road. There are still a lot of things with plantation in their names. Products, housing developments, country clubs, shutters, towns, roads. And realistically, it's probably going to stick around in many of them. But Kennedy Whiters has suggestions for the word plantation itself.
Hi, my name is Kennedy Whiters. I am an architect, also a business owner. I own my own boutique architecture firm that specializes in historic preservation and owner's representation, also known as construction management. I go by pronouns of she, her, and I'm also a Black woman.
Kennedy also runs Unredact the Facts, a research and advocacy project to unredact the facts of history to tell a fuller story for racial equity and healing.
I'm saying unredact the word plantation. There are many definitions for a plantation, but the Southern definition, plantation, it's like where people labored during the period of chattel slavery. Plantations were places of forced labor. They were forced labor camps, and other people are using this phrase to describe these places. I made an attempt on Wikipedia to add the descriptor forced labor camp to the word plantation, and that someone redacted my unredaction, actually.
I imagine fewer people would choose to have weddings at things called forced labor camps. You would hope.
I would hope. I mean, so the antebellum and plantation seem to glorify this period of time that was very horrific. It's a period of enslavement. It's a period of trauma. And I know, and it was a system that white people, Europeans, developed, created to build this country economically, socially, and knowing the history of what transpired back then. It's not, there's nothing to glamorize, even though people glamorize them, this antebellum period, and people dress in antebellum period clothing and for fun plantations. People continue to have weddings there at these places. The parallel I draw and I started looking at when I dissected the word plantation were the concentration camps in Germany. No one is having a wedding at Auschwitz.
In the interests of fact-checking, I ruined my own Google history by searching for can you get married at Auschwitz? And as far as I can see from the results, you cannot. There is a former Nazi concentration camp in Lithuania, a fort built in the 19th century where 5,000 to 10,000 Jews were killed in a six-week period in 1941. It's now a privately owned museum that has been hired for weddings. Plantation weddings, though, still a strong trend. Although at least now, when you Google them, you get a lot of results for why are people still getting married on plantations, among the pictures of newlywed couples, predominantly white couples, surprise, surprise, posing in an avenue of moss-draped trees or in front of a big house with white columns at the front.
The image that I have, as you mentioned, you know, tall columns, the setting, the landscape, is that there's this palatial appearing building, modeled after villas to assert wealth, dominance, power, and class by Europeans in the United States, what became the United States. And this palatial building surrounded by acres and acres and acres of land and typical crops that the enslaved Africans farmed were cotton, tobacco, especially on the southeastern coast of the United States, coffee, and sugar. And I'm just speaking of the United States. Then outside of the villa, and what people are starting to speak to more of now, there were outbuildings that people call slave cabins or cabins where enslaved Black people slept, that were their quarters. And these are buildings that the enslaved Africans built. And we want to make sure we talk about that. And enslaved Black people and Indigenous people built the White House too and the Capitol. U.S. Capitol that are in D.C. Yes, palatial estates. That's why the word plantation is associated with these words, because the buildings on the surface, they look architecturally, you know,
like a mini White House.
Yeah, they look very appealing. Like I said, they represent certain things because that's what we could talk another hour about architecture and the buildings and of like propaganda. That's just they're there to support a status.
There were about 46,000 plantations in operation in the American South by 1860, and now about 375 of them are plantation museums, with varying degrees of acknowledgement of what the white and wealthy inflicted upon enslaved African people and their children born into slavery on those sites.
Because we call it what it was. They were concentration camps. But yet in the United States, the honesty is just stripped from that and the horrors that happen there. White men raped Black women, Black children. As soon as you were able to give birth, you were bred, basically. And there were forced labor camps that were breeding places that they would separate white people, separating Black families, sending the Black girls and women to go to the forced labor camps. And sometimes they would not only force on men they didn't know, but even their own family members onto them to rape them, to create more Black people that white people enslaved to build up their capital in this country. And we can't just say the South, it was also in the North. And even if the North didn't have forced labor camps, they were profiting off the labor of enslaved Black and African people as well.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the language manages to de-emphasize the violence and the sexual violence. Mm-hmm.
But this is the trauma that we're talking, you know, that took place at these places that people continue to celebrate what's supposed to be one of the greatest things to happen in a person's life if they so choose. These are places, like I said, of just deep trauma.
Like, I don't even know how you could look at big white columns and think, oh, that's nice, knowing what those houses mean.
Right. And, you know, and perhaps it's the media that people allow themselves to see unless they receive it in a history lesson in school.
Even if you are taught things in history class, which a lot of us aren't even, it feels abstracted from real human experience or things that are still relevant to the present day, rather than things that are just kind of encapsulated in the past, like safely boxed away.
Yes. And as I continued on this research path, I recently was curious about, why are people using redacted grammar and language? Why do people use the passive voice?
Passive voice was mentioned. The word plantation is not the only linguistic component Kennedy has on watch. Throughout the month of February 2023, Black History Month, you can play Kennedy's redacted bingo at unredactthefacts.com.
So I just launched this fun venture to encourage people to look for ways in which individuals and organizations are using redacted grammar and language to communicate historical narratives about Black history, which is U.S. history. February is Black History Month, and so this is a time of year when we see an increase in these historical narratives. And so you can sign up on the website on redactthefacts.com that has an online bingo card that I set up. And the squares are different examples of redacted grammar and language. So once you see a square, you tag the bingo card and keep a running list of the spot on your card and where you heard or read the redacted grammar and language. It could be on Twitter, it could be on Instagram, a website, or even a webinar or event that you attend. So one example, if you come across a euphemism for white people in a sentence.
Like what?
The wealthy elite. That's one example.
Landowners?
Landowners, yes. Landowners, enslavers, and by the end of February, February 28th, email your completed bingo card and your list of where you found and heard the redacted grammar and language.
Among the other squares on Kennedy's redacted bingo card are passive voice description of slavery, passive voice description of lynching, and passive voice description of civil rights movement. The passive voice is such a problem because
it hides who did what to whom. There's intentionality in removing words and phrases and to omit certain parts of a history intentionally. And so what I saw in what, you know, sparked this whole journey of research, and I saw other posts in 2020, but the first one that I saw was early June, the national leader in the United States for historic preservation, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, they have an initiative called Tell the Full American Story, and it's tied into their African American Action Heritage Fund that does great work in fundraising to finance historic preservation projects at Black historic sites across the U.S. But while they were saying they're telling the full American story, they're doing it in one regard, through my lens, highlighting the contributions of African Americans in the United States through financing these projects. But in the way that they're telling the story, I found that they were using grammar and language that did not tell a full story, and that the actual, if we dive into the mechanics of sentences and the story, they're using the passive voice in particular. That's what first caught my eye in 2020.
The National Trust for Historic Preservation had posted about a building they own in Washington, D.C., saying, I quote, where people were held in bondage within view of the White House.
Who were held in bondage? Who held them in bondage? To me, it seems as though this passive voice sentence is writing from the perspective of empathy for a white audience that might be offended, who might feel shame about reading that people connected to them, their ancestors, held people in bondage. But this is history, we know that happened. So why aren't we writing about it in a very direct, open way? So that's where I began looking at reframing Tell the Full Story to being more direct about what we're actually seeing and what we're actually hearing, which is redacted history. And so flipping that to say, let's try something new. Let's have a vision for a different way of writing and speaking the narrative, historical narratives. Why not unredact the facts of history to tell a fuller story for racial equity and healing? But also be honest about why people are not telling us these parts of the history, why we're encouraged to write in the passive voice. I go back to being a seventh grader and hearing my English teacher tell us that the passive voice is a professional way of writing. And this is what we're taught in school.
In like a lot of creative writing classes, they say don't use the passive voice. But comparing that to what you were taught, where they were like, it's the more official tone to strike, and maybe that's because it does remove the activity from individuals and therefore makes it seem like it's just inevitable rather than the choices of humans to do it. And it kind of removes humans from the equation, even though humans have done all these things actively.
And now knowing what I know now is that why are we taught that the passive voice is a professional way of writing? And we can say from a legal perspective that there's a concern about libel, and because you're saying who did what to whom, and you're stating, making claims about an action that someone did to someone else. And it can be, we live in a litigious society. So there's some protection involved in that. But who are we protecting? And that's where I've been, going down this rabbit hole recently, but about writing with empathy for the audience. And who is the audience that we are writing empathy for?
I mean, looking at who runs most media organizations in US and UK.
Why do people use the passive voice? Why are people using redacted grammar and language? It's by design there to create distance between the author of the text and the reader of the text and the events that they are reading and writing about. That's what the passive voice is like by design constructed to do. Mental distance. And so is it for reasons of protecting our emotions and our feelings so that we don't become too close to these traumatic historical events? And in that regard, I go back to what I said earlier about there's intention behind writing with this redacted grammar and language to hide history by design to protect white supremacy, yes, but also maybe there's also some element of just protecting our mental and emotional space, because not only are white people using this, Black people use it too. And then other people of color, that's another, grammar framing that I'm curious about, is like Black trauma versus the people who are creating the trauma. Because what I've read in defense of the passive voice is a desire to focus on the recipient of the violent act, the victim, the survivor, to shine a light on them in order to not glamorize, say, someone that the media calls a white supremacist or murderer, or just someone that does this very violent act. And I understand that.
I wonder if there are any languages that don't have passive voice and how things play out in those.
Yes. There's a Black woman poet, and I'm honoring her now, calling her an environmental designer because that's how she also wanted to be described as, June Jordan. In 1982, she published an essay about the passive voice, actually, and another article too, where she said that the passive voice is basically, it's ingrained in standard English or white English, as opposed to African-American vernacular English that doesn't have the passive voice. You can say that, quote, standard white English, there is this element of the passive voice that perhaps is to create distance in events between the author, the reader, and the event. But yes, there are languages that do not have the passive voice, and one of them, the African-American vernacular English, or AVE.
Britain is excellent at avoiding talking about or educating about or even acknowledging its history of participation in the transatlantic slave trade and long-term repercussions thereof. But there is a brilliant podcast series that can fill you in, Human Resources, made by Broccoli Productions, hosted by one of my favourite journalists, Moya Lothian-McLean, who is descended from both enslaved Black Africans and white slave owners. While you're in your podcast app of choice getting it, subscribe to some Black Joy too. I recommend Private Affairs, a sexy, funny fiction show about dating in Australia, and The Stacks, a great podcast about reading hosted by Tracy Thomas, and she runs a monthly virtual book club too. Get amongst it! Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is embrave, verb transitive. To make showy, to decorate, bracket Spencer. I think that means it's from Spencer, not that you decorate Spencer. To inspire with bravery. Try using embrave in an email today. Today you heard from Kennedy Whiters, who is an architect. Her firm is Workshop Kilowatt. And she runs Unredact the Facts, researching the use of redacted grammar and language in historical narratives. And she posts about it on Instagram and Twitter, and at unredactthefacts.com, where you can find the redacted bingo card too, to play this month. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with original music by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Thanks to Nancy Friedman for her useful piece on Visual Thesaurus about plantation-named things being rebranded. Our ad partner is Multitude. If you want to hear me make your product sound compelling, you can sponsor an episode of The Illusionist. Contact Multitude at multitude.production/ads. If you like The Illusionist and you have some spare cash, join the Illusiverse. Go to theillusionist.org/donate, and for a mere $2 American per month, or more dollars if you absolutely insist, you get behind-the-scenes info about each episode, plus spoilers for upcoming episodes. You get fortnightly live streams with relaxing readings from a variety of reference books, and you get the Illusiverse Discord community, where you can hang out with your adorable fellow podcast enthusiasts and discuss such things as special candy dishes and the etymology of waffle. We're also watching the current season of Great Pottery Throwdown together, the most wholesome show on television in the most wholesome place on the internet. Join us at theillusionist.org/donate. Find Illusionist Show on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter, and you can hear or read every episode, get links to more information about each topic they're in, and see the full dictionary entries for all the randomly selected words, and tell me about your renaming projects at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.